summer break is almost upon us. But how about this? The next school year will look very different from this one for kids on the First Coast. And good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, new mask guidance for kids and schools. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, more school news as a photoshopped St. John's County High School yearbook causes a national uproar. We'll tell you about that. First, though, here's your COVID update for the day. 1,874 new cases reported in the state from Monday and 80 new deaths. The death toll in the state from the virus stands at 36,581. It keeps going up every day, folks, so please go get your vaccine. Well, next school year, students in the Duval County Public Schools will no longer be required to wear face masks on campus. And much the same is playing out in school districts around the region, like St. John's and Nassau counties. Now, the news comes one day after a survey for parents, students, and employees wrapped up, and they asked everyone to weigh in on the wearing of masks in class, temperature checks, desk shields, and more. The district's move on masks mirrors a number of Florida school districts. They're under pressure from the state to make face coverings optional next school year. Now, at the same time as vaccinated Americans return to what amounts to a pre-pandemic life this summer, one group will be left out, kids under the age of 12 who cannot yet be vaccinated. So that poses a question. If you have young children, how do you protect them when everyone starts socializing again? Dr. Jeff Goldhagen is professor in chief with the Division of Community and Societal Pediatrics at UF College of Medicine, JAX. He's also president of the International Society for Social Pediatrics and Child Health, and he's on the line. Hi, Dr. Goldhagen. Always good to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
We're talking kids and COVID on the show right now. If you've got kids in your house, listen up and give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Well, let me begin by asking you your thoughts about this new rule for face masks in local schools. It's going to be downgraded from mandatory to voluntary at elementary schools, strongly encouraged, but voluntary at elementary schools, and voluntary at secondary schools. I mean, let's be honest, that means kids aren't going to be wearing masks for the most part come fall. What are your thoughts, Dr. Goldhagen?
Well, so all of this began several weeks ago with the CDC recommendations, changes in the CDC recommendations. I think that politics has now invaded the Centers for Disease Control. Those decisions, I think, represent a profound disregard for the health and well-being of children, particular children under the age of 12. And so we see those recommendations now permeating our school systems. And we know very definitively that children who are in environments and schools where there are no masking requirements, there are at least several studies that have demonstrated this, are at increased risk for COVID. And as you mentioned, we're still seeing thousands of people every day test positive for COVID. We're still seeing around 100 people a day dying in the state of Florida with COVID. And so to a certain extent, the situation today puts children at greater risk than they were yesterday.
This is an issue simply because the majority of school-aged children are still too young to qualify for vaccination. A study done last fall found that infection rates were 37% lower in schools where teachers and staff were required to wear masks. So, you know, kids under 12 will be able to be vaccinated, but not by the time school starts again in August, correct?
That's correct.
So that's not a great timeline for a pediatrician like you.
No, and the issue is the teachers, right? So teachers will not need to be masked. The intention that, in fact, people who are unvaccinated will, in fact, continue to wear a mask is ludicrous, given the fact that these folks, many of them, were not wearing masks when they were required. And so going into an environment in which there are unvaccinated adults and unvaccinated children who are all unmasked is no different than where we were before. And again, in many respects, very much an increased risk for children, because in the past, there were mask requirements in schools. So we're eliminating the mask requirements. We're eliminating the protections that we know work in an environment in which we know that there will be risk for spread of disease. It makes no sense from a scientific perspective, but it's all about politics and partisanship invading our systems.
We're talking kids and COVID on the show with Dr. Jeff Goldhagen. Give us a call, 549-2937. Here's an email from a parent. I am the mom of a child suffering from long COVID. I am very nervous about sending my 8-year-old back to school in St. Johns County this fall with no masks and no access to vaccines until well after the school year begins. And so, could you talk about this a little bit, Dr. Goldhagen, because certainly there are a lot of parents out there rejoicing at the lifting of the mask orders in schools. They feel it's been unfair and burdensome for their kids. However, there are other parents out there who have had kids get sick, and they are worried about exposing their children to the virus this fall. You know, 3 months out, do you think enough more Americans will be vaccinated that this might not be such a matter of concern or not?
Well, we know that at least at this point, the vaccine hesitancy will not result in allowing us to reach herd immunity. So the answer to your question is we will not reach herd immunity, and that the precedent has been established that there are many people who are not vaccinated who will not wear masks. But the most important thing that your caller mentioned is the fact that she has a child who had COVID and is now continuing to suffer. This misperception that in fact children are not at risk has put increasing numbers of kids at risk. We've seen well over 50 or so children in our children's hospital who have had MISC. We know that.
Can you explain what that is for those who aren't aware?
So MISC is the multi-system inflammatory disease that affects children, can affect children long after they've actually been infected. And it can be fatal, and it can certainly result in long-term impact on multiple organ systems. So children die from COVID. Children suffer significantly and end up in our intensive care units. Children get infected. Children get infected and have long COVID. And what's critically important is that we do not know the long-term impact of even asymptomatic diseases in children, so that there's no reason not to expect that years from now that there will be lingering effects of COVID infections that were asymptomatic in children. So this is a serious disease for adults. It's a serious disease for children, and we need to be protecting them at all costs, and we need to be protecting them in our schools.
And by the way, let's point out, Moderna said Tuesday its COVID vaccine was found to be 100% effective in a study of adolescents aged 12 to 17. They want to get emergency approval to start vaccinating that age group beginning next month. Pfizer is already doing that, doctor, but of course, kids under age 12 are not yet eligible, and that's the issue that so many families are dealing with.
Yes, and there is the expectation, and there are the trials happening now for vaccinating children from 5 and actually below 5, so that the expectation would be that sometime in the next year, we'll be vaccinating all children, and then the decisions have to be made by parents as to whether or not they will get their children vaccinated. It's important to note that the American Academy of Pediatrics has come out strongly in favor of vaccinating children between 12 and 17. At this point, my expectation will be that, in fact, they will strongly recommend vaccinating younger children as well.
It's your chance right now to connect with one of the nation's leading pediatricians, Dr. Jeff Goldhagen of UF College of Medicine, Jax, 549-2937. Julie in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Julie. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, and not sure that you're going to be able to answer this, but did parents behave like this in Americans when the polio vaccine came out, when it came to protecting their children and the general community and other people's children?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, Julie. Let's take a little walk back through time and talk about the polio vaccine, Dr. Goldhagen. You know, my folks used to tell us that they were given the vaccine at school as kids. They drank a little cup of some kind of solution and they were vaccinated against polio when they were little kids in school, which sort of begs the question, why not vaccinate children in schools as we did during the polio era? And why isn't America culturally the way it was then when everybody got on board and got vaccinated for polio, including children?
Well, unfortunately, I'm old enough to actually be able to answer that question personally. And interestingly enough, I grew up in Pittsburgh where Salk invented the vaccine and was part of the first group of kids without informed consent by any means to actually be vaccinated. And we were vaccinated in schools. And no, there was not the vaccine hesitancy, in part because the polio epidemic hit children very hard, and parents saw actually their children suffering significantly and die. So there wasn't a vaccine hesitancy. There was also a belief in science. This was in the early 50s or the mid-50s. Science was just coming into its own. Vaccines, interestingly enough, came into existence in the early 50s. So this was one of the first vaccines that existed. And there was a belief that science was important and a belief in science and a belief, in fact, that the government was there to protect people. That's a very different environment today. Certainly from a political standpoint, but also the fact that polio hit children very hard and they were the primary group that was affected was a different environment than COVID.
It certainly is. But, you know, we've spent a lot of time on this show interviewing guests about the safety and efficacy of the vaccines. People have said, well, they brought these to market too quickly. What's your response to those who feel that not enough research was done to ensure that the vaccines are safe?
Well, that's a complete misperception that there has been extensive research on the mRNA vaccine for decades, actually. And so this was not new research. It was the application of research that has been in place and continuing for many, many years. And so the safety issue has been tested in the past, and the efficacy have been tested in the past, so that, in fact, this was just the translation of knowledge that currently existed into vaccine technology and not new research and not new technology.
Yvonne on the South Side. Hi, Yvonne.
Good morning. Glad to be speaking with you.
You too.
I just wanted to call to make the parents and family members aware of something we found out yesterday. A neighbor is a long-term driver for contractors who run some of the buses here for county school children, has not been vaccinated. And when we asked him why, all he could say was Trump and Tucker Carlson. And we did a little walk away, but I feel that parents need to find out from their representatives here in town just what's going on with bus drivers that don't have to be vaccinated.
Hmm. Thanks, Yvonne. You know, it's ironic considering that the president and the first lady, before they left the White House, got the vaccine, but they didn't talk about it publicly. All of the other living former presidents, Dr. Goldhagen, urged Americans to get the vaccine, showed themselves getting the vaccine. President Trump did it secretly, but he was vaccinated. So there's still so much disinformation about the vaccination effort that leads people to rationalizing not getting the vaccine. And that is going to be a problem for school kids this fall, because most adults by the fall who have decided they want to get vaccinated will have been vaccinated. And that just leaves the kids.
Well, that's a fascinating issue, and one that there's not a correct answer for sure. And that is whether or not teachers and school personnel and people coming into contact with children should be required to be vaccinated, and or if not required to be vaccinated, should have to be identified as to whether or not they're vaccinated or not. And that brings in a whole host of privacy issues that need to be discussed out in the open. I, for one, if I had a child, my own child, in the school system, I do have grandchildren who go to preschool. I think personally, and there are certainly arguments for and against it, that I should know whether or not the teacher and the personnel in the school that my children are going to are vaccinated or not. And if they're not vaccinated, then that puts my children, my grandchildren, at significant risk, and in particular at significant risk if there are no masking requirements. And so these are the critical questions that need to be addressed. And from a personal standpoint, from a public health standpoint, I think it's critical that that the science and public health triumph in this situation, and that we protect our children. We are profoundly disrespecting their health and well-being by putting them into environments that present extreme risk for them, or at least risk for them, with a misperception by the public that they're not at risk for the disease and that they won't have immediate and or long-term consequences from becoming infected.
We're speaking with Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, pediatrician with a national platform. He is based at UF College of Medicine. Here's an email from Mary. I'm so disappointed our state is once again playing politics with the lives of our most vulnerable. Children under 12 should be protected. It is not that hard to wear a piece of cloth over your face to ensure kids aren't at risk for a deadly disease that causes many kids to suffer long term. Enough playing politics with all of our lives, she says. Here's a tweet. Get the kids vaccinated. Otherwise, they have no protection. Masks should remain mandatory until that happens. Best to protect rather than make a mistake, he says. Here's another tweet, doctor. What about vaccines? If we aren't going to require a vaccination for COVID in schools, why should we require a vaccination for anything? That's a bigger issue than masks. What about that? We require children to be immunized before they can go to school for a whole host of diseases. And so why isn't COVID-19 being added to the vaccine schedule for kids?
Well, that's a really excellent question. And I think the issue is and will continue to be the politics that has pervaded and invaded our system at this point in time. And so so there's no reason not to expect in the future that the COVID vaccine won't be added to the vaccine requirements. Right now, it would be difficult to do that because it's still under emergency utilization. So once it becomes moves out of the environment of an emergency utilization by the CDC, then it'll become reasonable to require it to be added to the vaccine regimen. I might add also that school personnel are required to be vaccinated. They are required to be tested for TB and so on. So there would be no reason to not require them to also have the COVID vaccine, and we require them to get influenza vaccine. So there is a precedent for requiring adults as well as children to be vaccinated, and it's just because of the politics of COVID that is preventing this from happening.
Grant emails the show, on one side is science. They make recommendations based on best practices and to protect us all. On the other side is a cult, beholden to conspiracies, individuals, and commerce, and not even in that order. One side lives in a realm of reality, the other some dystopian fantasy, he says. Okay, let's take a few more calls. 549-2937. Eric in Arlington. Hello, Eric.
Yes, good morning. I continue to be confounded by the anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers. And the reason is, a practical one, is it such a great encumbrance on people to put on a mask? I mean, you know, sometimes there may be government mandates. Like, for instance, I'm where the Second Amendment is concerned, I personally think guns are too available and they're too easy to buy and ammunition and all that. But say someone's a hunter and the government says, you know, you can't buy a gun. I could see where people might get excited about that, I guess. But asking someone to put on a mask, I mean, we expect people to wear pants and shirts. I mean, it's just confounding. And I wonder when it changed in America. I'd like to be able to put my finger on exactly when. This attitude, it's almost as, it's like not cooperating for the sake of not cooperating, which really, I don't know, is kind of nonsensical, but thank you.
Yeah, Eric, thank you. You know, and plenty of people have written about this. They've called it a culture of narcissism in America, a culture of selfishness, a culture of grievance. However you want to define it, what it adds up to is we're not all on the same page, unfortunately, about what needs to be done to get this horrible time behind us. So, Dr. Goldhagen, let me, if I could, end on at least a bit of a positive note. Pfizer says vaccines for kids age 2 and up could come as soon as September. That lines up well with the start of preschool and school. It would hopefully give parents who are concerned the opportunity to send their kids to school with a little more confidence.
Yes. Very much so. I think it will take several months really after immunizing young children to determine whether or not, in fact, how efficacious the vaccine is, but more importantly, to really get an understanding as to whether or not they can become asymptomatic carriers of the disease, of the infection. So it will take, I think, several months really after releasing the vaccine and after having a number of children vaccinated to get a really good understanding of it. And the other issue, though, is that there will remain a number of unvaccinated adults in the environment. And that's going to be critically important, in particular for children, young children who are not able to get the vaccine and are therefore at risk for contracting the disease.
Always so good to have you. He's Dr. Jeff Goldhagen at UF College of Medicine, JAX. Thank you so much, Dr. Jeff.
No, thank you very much for making this the critical issue that it is.
We'll continue to follow it, and much more still ahead. Meanwhile, on the show later in the hour, look at what's good around town this week. But up next.
I had a college stack of acceptance letters on one side of my desk and a positive pregnancy test on the other.
College is hard enough, but imagine doing it with a newborn baby. We speak with the author of Pregnant Girl next. We'll be right back. Well, her name is Nicole Lynn Lewis, and she's the founder of Generation Hope. It's a group working with teen parents to apply to and graduate from college. But Nicole is a former teen mom herself, and she was actually homeless when she graduated high school and began attending the College of William and Mary. In her new memoir, she writes with candor about the tough choices she had to make about how to afford college and raise her daughter at the same time, and the ways that the system was not built for student parents, especially young women of color. This is a fascinating memoir, and I spoke with Nicole Lynn Lewis about her book, Pregnant Girl. Take a listen. Hi, Nicole. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've heard a lot about what's going on college campuses lately with student debt, campus culture, but not as much about the subject of your fascinating book, college parents, student parents, of which you were one. Your story is really fascinating. I just don't think people realize how hard it was for you and what you achieved despite some pretty stiff odds. Can you tell us about your experience going to school at William and Mary and how that began for you as a young parent?
Well, I got pregnant my senior year of high school. I was, ready to go off to college. I had a college stack of acceptance letters on one side of my desk and a positive pregnancy test on the other. It was a really difficult time to try to figure out how do those things come together and how can I really carve out a future for myself and for my daughter. And even though I was this star student, honor roll student, I heard the same message that many young women hear in that situation. Your life is over. You're not going to go to college. You're not going to be successful. And it was difficult to kind of push through, those negative stereotypes, that rhetoric that is so prevalent, and try to really see something in my future for myself. But I was determined and really focused. And I knew even then at a young age that education was critical for me to be able to provide for my daughter. That was something that was very clear to me. And when I started at the College of William and Mary, I had a 3-month-old baby.
I know. I can't even imagine. I mean,
yeah, it was a crazy time.
How'd you do it? I don't know how you did it. How did you do this? It would seem impossible to most people.
It was a daily act of survival, to be honest with you. It was, just figuring out how to get through the next 24 hours. From an emotional standpoint, there was no room in my life for anything but being a mom and being a college student. Financially, it was extremely difficult. There were meals that I skipped. There were the tough decisions between textbooks and baby wipes and diapers and the impossible task of trying to find affordable childcare. And, every day was just about, can I keep all the balls in the air? Can I keep a roof over our heads and food on the table? And can I get my assignments in on time? And it was all consuming.
How'd you pay for it? It's hard enough to pay for college without having a child to care for. How did you pay for everything? How did you meet that challenge?
I had to make my grants and my loans stretch across, 12 months of the year. And as with many parenting students, my financial aid not only had to cover the cost of college, like the tuition and, those kinds of things and fees, but it also had to cover my living expenses. And the benefit that I had when I was in college is that my Pell Grants, my financial aid were able to barely cover the cost of me going to school. Today, 20 years later, the reality is the cost of higher education has skyrocketed. And
yeah.
I would not have been able to do what I did then if I was in that situation today.
Let's talk, too, about the fact that you were a young student at the College of William and Mary of color. The majority of student parents on college campuses are people of color. Tell me about your experience with that part of your story.
Well, I think any student of color on a predominantly white institution's campus is acutely aware of the fact that they are a small group in a sea of students, and that there are stereotypes and all sorts of assumptions that are made about them by virtue of the fact that they're a student of color there. You know, I remember having friends who were questioned at William & Mary about whether they had really earned their spot. You know, were they there because of affirmative action? My husband was a football player and was often assumed that he was there because he played football and not because of how smart he was. So you're up against all of those stereotypes, in addition to the fact that as a person of color coming into higher education, you know, the odds are really stacked against you just to get your foot in the door in terms of, you know, being a college student. And so when you layer on top of that that you're a parent, then it really becomes difficult because you have all of those disadvantages coming into higher ed. You have the assumptions, the stereotypes, and then you have this additional responsibility of being a caregiver. And on most college campuses, you know, you're invisible as a parent and college student. People do not talk about your needs, your experiences.
Yeah.
They are not trying to set up supports to make sure that you're successful. So you have both of those things really working against you.
I can't even imagine how isolating that must have felt for you. So the story does have a happy ending in the sense that you did graduate from honors from the College of William & Mary. You've gone on to found a nonprofit, Generation Hope, to help teen parents apply to college, stay in school, find financial aid. Tell us about Generation Hope.
Yeah, when I graduated from William & Mary, I just had this tremendous sense of wanting to make sure that other young parents could be successful in parenting students of any age. And so moved to the D.C. region and was looking for a nonprofit that was focused on this work. None existed in the D.C. area and very, very few across the country. And I just knew from my own experience that it can be game-changing, you know, for young families to be able to have that access to higher education and to have that credential to allow them to provide for their families. And so it became a real mission for me. And I realized everything that I had been through as a young mom was really preparing me for starting this organization. And, our focus is helping teen parents in the D.C. and become college graduates. We also help their kids get ready for kindergarten at the same time. But now we're also doing national work to advocate for the needs of parenting students all across the country who, as I said, are, you know, it's 1 in 5 students across the country are parenting, but they're really not getting the support that they need.
Well, there's more at generationhope.org and inside the pages of your memoir, Pregnant Girl, a story of teen motherhood, college, and creating a better future for young families. Nicole Lynn Lewis, what an incredible story you have to tell. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, a Photoshop controversy over a high school yearbook in St. Johns County has drawn national criticism. Female students pictured in the yearbook had their pictures altered without their consent, basically to cover up shoulders and chests. No boys' photos were altered in the same yearbook, even though some male students were pictured wearing nothing but a Speedo. So what to make of this? Well, Dr. Lorna Bracewell is assistant professor of political science at Flagler College and author of Why We Lost the Sex Wars, Sexual Freedom in the Me Too Era. And she's on the line. Hi, Dr. Bracewell.
Good morning.
Good to have you. So the superintendent in St. Johns County Schools says they're going to make changes to their process about yearbook editorial design and even the dress code because there's been a national outcry after someone at Bartram Trail High School altered dozens of photos of female students. Many people have probably seen the before and after images on social media. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, so that this story has been catapulted into the national consciousness is really a testament, I think, to the activism of these young girls and also their parents. Which was really inspiring to see yesterday watching the school board meeting discussing this issue, to see the girls speaking out on their own behalf. They're supported by their families. And I think it's important to note that you know, while this story happens to be the one grabbing national headlines right now, these dress code controversies are really, really common all across the country and have been going on for years.
Yeah.
You see similar controversies over disparate enforcement of these dress codes, and now add St. John's County to a very long list.
Right, exactly right. And, you know, I've seen it with my own eyes. We have two daughters, and particularly in middle school, the dress code violations were flying. And what my daughters complained about, and all of their friends did too, was that boys were almost never dress coded. It was almost always an attempt to police the girls' bodies. And you definitely see
those kinds of disparities, and also racial disparities. I think it's important to keep in mind, while those don't seem to necessarily have been in play in the St. John's County instance, there's many instances of, you know, black girls being singled out because their hair is deemed distracting because they have it in, you know, braided extensions or something like that. So, yeah, the disparities in enforcement is a real problem.
So this is a cultural problem then. And the complaint that the girls in Bartram Trail raised with the St. John's County superintendent and school board is, when you Photoshop our pictures to cover up a tiny bit of cleavage or showing a little bit of shoulder, the message you're sending us is that our bodies are inherently sexual, even though we're not even sexual beings yet. What's ironic is that the kids seem to have more awareness of that than the adults in their testimony that they gave to the school board.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that there's something perverse about the interest and attention that is given to policing young girls' bodies. And, you know, there's one example. This was in Bradenton, Florida in 2018. A 17-year-old, Lizzie Martinez, was pulled out of class to be interrogated by her school dean. The dean asked if she was wearing a bra. He then told her to stand up, jump up and down, and move around so he could, quote, see the motion of her breasts. And then he ordered her to put Band-Aids over her nipples before she could return to class. And this whole ordeal resulted in her missing, like, 2 hours of school that day. And imagine the shame and the embarrassment and humiliation of being asked to literally jump up and down in front of your school dean.
You know,
so you could watch the motion of your breast. It's very bizarre.
I have to tell you, when this was going on with our kids, I had a conversation with a retired high school principal about this, and they said, well, you don't understand. We have to do these dress code policies because otherwise the boys will act inappropriately around some of the girls and cause a lot of distraction and a lot of problems. And what I said was, well, you're putting all of the onus on the girls to keep order and you're not expecting the boys, you're not holding them to any standard of conduct. You're putting all of the onus on the girls. To me, that didn't seem fair as a parent. I mean, I'm losing my objectivity here a little bit here. But certainly that's what they're seeing in St. John's County, because now they're looking to actually change the dress code in St. John's County because this has been such a flap.
Yeah. So I think that oftentimes these dress codes are really looking at the problem through the wrong end of the telescope, right? We frame these dress codes in such a way to make girls' bodies or girls' clothing the source of the disruption or the cause of the problem, when in reality, the source of the disruption and the cause of the problem is quite often the sexist harassment and abuse that gets directed at girls. So why not deal with that instead of shrugging it off with a kind of boys will be boys? Why not educate boys and men to not be distracted by their peers and to not engage in misogyny and objectification of women's bodies, right? That seems like a better way to approach the problem. And as you pointed out, the school district is now revisiting the dress code, which I think is really, really great that they are being responsive to the concerns that parents and students have been raising in the district for a long time. I do worry, based on what I kind of, there was like a preview draft shared of some of the changes that the county is considering. I do worry that those don't go far enough. Hmm. And I would encourage school board members, but also, you know, community members who are interested in this, to take a look at a model dress code reform that was actually put together by the Oregon chapter of the National Organization of Women back in 2016 when they had their own version of what our community is going through right now. I think that this model reform has a lot of virtues, and one of them is that it's very clear. It does not use vague language like distracting or disruptive. That kind of vague language allows for all sorts of implicit biases, whether they be gendered or raced or classed, to seep into dress code enforcement. So they do away with that ambiguous, vague language. The code is very streamlined. It is minimalist. It is gender neutral. Its aim is to facilitate participation in learning, as well as health and safety of students and the adults right in schools. Its aim is not to impose sexist, racist, classist, and heteronormative ideals of what's respectable or appropriate, which I think is often the aim of a lot of dress codes.
Hmm. Yes, and I see one recommendation they're going to vote on in St. John's is to completely remove the word modest from the dress code. The adult employee who photoshopped the images without the student's consent said she was doing it so that the images were more modest. That's modest is a loaded word, isn't it?
It is indeed. And this jumped out at me in the story. So my scholarly expertise, I study the history of feminist political thought. So back in 1792, Mary Wollstonecraft, a feminist philosopher, she wrote a book on the education of women, arguing that they should receive an education, called A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. And she discusses modesty at length in that text. And a point she makes that I think rang true then and still rings true today is that modesty is a virtue. And if you want people to be modest, you have to cultivate within them a capacity for virtue. And what that means is you have to make them independent, and you have to give them good judgment, and you have to give them the kind of resources that they need to be sovereign over their own bodies and their own persons and their own behavior. You can't sort of impose modesty externally through commanding rote rule following. In fact, Mary Wollstonecraft points out that's a recipe for immodesty, right? So I think that it would do us good to recall the insight of Mary Wollstonecraft from, you know, literally like 300 years ago into this whole discourse on modesty, that our goal should be to make young girls and women independent, to give them good judgment, to give them a sense mm-hmm. of their own power and their own authority over their own bodies.
We'll leave it with that powerful idea. Thank you so much, Dr. Lorna Bracewell, Flagler College. We appreciate you being with us.
I appreciate the invitation. Thanks.
And in a moment, some good news and notes for your Wednesday. We'll be right back.
CNS Healthcare is offering an agitation associated with Alzheimer's dementia research study. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they shown verbal or physical symptoms of agitation? Learn more at 904-281-5757. Greenwood School serves students that learn differently by identifying their skills and strengths. Greenwood teachers help them grow into confident, capable high school graduates with a multisensory approach, small class sizes, and no high-stakes standardized tests. Limited space available. More at greenwoodjacks.org.
I'm Robin Young. The last time we spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist Lori Garrett, she was sounding an alarm about COVID-19.
We are heading into a winter of true hell. I mean, the gates of Hades have opened.
Well, that is still true in India, but are we finally in spring? Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Yusuf Salam, one of five men who were convicted as teenagers, then exonerated in the Central Park jogger case. Their story was dramatized in the Netflix series When They See Us. Salam reflects on his experience in a new memoir called Better Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Electronic dance music, or EDM, has defined an entire generation of music lovers. The documentary Underplayed asks tough questions about why so many women find it hard to succeed in the space. I'm Jen White. We meet its director and hear more about the female pioneers and next generation artists who are pushing for change. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, this month, University of Miami coral researchers achieved a significant milestone. For the first time, they used frozen coral sperm to make coral babies. WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich tells us these test tube babies could potentially grow up to be better able to fend off disease and the devastating impacts from climate change on Florida's ailing reef.
After stony coral disease began spreading from Virginia Key in 2014, researchers knew they were facing a double whammy. Reefs already under stress from warming oceans driven by climate change were now being wiped out by a new disease. Scientists have been trying to rebuild the reef using staghorn coral grown in nurseries, but that really wasn't going to fix the problem in the long run.
There was a lot of really concern that we may have sort of all of our eggs in one basket.
Andrew Baker is a marine biologist at UM's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science.
We were just restoring what you might call a monospecies, a single sort of cultivar of one species, and in some cases, even just a few genotypes of one particular species, and that wasn't really ecosystem restoration.
So scientists began collecting coral before they were infected. They wanted to create a Noah's Ark for different species to replant once they found a cure or the disease petered out. Baker and other scientists also began looking for coral that survived the disease to harvest eggs and sperm. Last August, WLRN tagged along when they spent several buggy nights off Key Biscayne during a full moon when coral spawn.
These are the backwater inshore environments, shallow, turbid, murky. And we think that maybe these corals are, you know, resilient to all kinds of stresses because that's where they've been growing.
Baker has long believed that coral which survive harsh environments could be used to help breed coral more resilient to climate change and other stresses. Several years ago, he rescued some from Port Miami before it was dredged. Now, if they could just figure out how to produce them more efficiently.
In theory, we could harness the power of sexual reproduction to also inject some of that diversity back out onto the reefs. That's our hope in the long run.
In August, they never could find spawning coral to collect eggs and sperm.
Nothing yet, huh?
This month, they finally succeeded, using frozen sperm and fresh eggs from disease-free wild coral and rescued coral. They finally made some babies. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami.
And here is some more good news for your week. Let's give a shout out to the Women's Giving Alliance. They are celebrating their 20th anniversary this month by giving out nearly $600,000 in grants to 10 local nonprofits, including Ability Housing, Lutheran Social Services, Generation W, Family Promise of Jacksonville, Sanctuary of Northeast Florida, UF Health, and more. So congrats to everyone. Well, also, we want to give big congrats to Vistar Credit Union and Goodwill of North Florida. They're coming together to support the community through the Kids Hope Alliance Mayor's Youth at Work Partnership. This will give high school kids the chance to get some paid summer internships at more than a dozen local companies. Vistar will serve as the financial partner for the program and contribute curriculum through workshops that help students gain the skills they need to succeed in the current and future economy. A shout out to the UNF LGBTQ Center. They're presenting their first ever drag queen brunch featuring Trinity the Tuck, winner of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Season 4. That is sure to be a fun event. The theme is Be True, Be Proud, Be Brave, and it's a celebration of Pride Month in Jacksonville. Last but not least, there's been lots of calls from citizens recently for more water access, and they're in luck. The city has many new projects nearing completion. Make sure to join us tomorrow when Lisa Gruba gives us an update on Wild Florida and a look at all of the new docks, fishing piers, and waterfront parks popping up around the area. If you're a paddler of kayaks, paddle boards, or canoes, we'll tell you a great place to go for information to get out and enjoy our miles and miles of waterways. And if you've got some good news you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, send us an email and we'll consider adding it to our What's Good Wednesdays, heard every Wednesday on the radio and also in our newsletter, which goes out later today. Drop us a line if you want to subscribe. And thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 and our podcast up later today wherever you like to listen. You can always listen through the WJCT app. Download that, too. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Wednesday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.